Good evening and welcome to another episode of Grains of Wisdom, an online webinar from Powerscore Distillery in which we are having insightful conversations on all things to do with Irish whiskey with our master distiller, Noel Sweeney. We are genuinely excited this evening to have an international award recognized expert in whiskey. Mr. Dave Broome, a Glasgow Scotsman, has spent over 30 years writing about alcohol and whiskey, and has over 12 books, two of which Rum and Drink won the Glenfiddich Award. Whiskey, the Manual, was awarded Best Spirits Book at the Spirits Awards in 2015. And the World Atlas of Whiskey has been a landmark publication. His most recent book, The Way of Whiskey, A Journey into Japanese Whiskey, appeared in 2017, and that too has been awarded a John Avery Prize at the Andre Simon Awards in 2018. As well as being a regular radio and TV contributor, he co-wrote the documentary Cuba in a Bottle and wrote and presented the whiskey cultural documentary The Amber Light, which has recently won the best program at this year's Fortnum & Mason Awards. He's been a contributing editor to both Whiskey Magazine and ScotchWhiskey.com and continues to write for a number of international titles. He launched his own website, the whiskeymanual.uk in 2020, and I'm sure you'll all be having a look at that after the webinar. But Dave has also been in great demand by many drinks companies around the world for training and speaking, and also gives regular talks at international whiskey events. So it's without further ado, we're delighted to have you with us this evening, David, and I know you'll be putting Noel through his paces and we'll all be having a really good and interesting conversation. So I'll hand over to you now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I didn't quite recognise myself there. It sounded dreadfully egotistical. Noel, hello.
You're very modest.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you get a PR, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, nothing. It's great.
How are you? I'm good. Yourself?
Yeah. Enjoying the life, you know. This lockdown, you know, it's not too bad. At least you get to meet interesting people, even if it is on Zoom, you know. But it's a different way of doing things. But it's great to be able to be here this evening and have a wee chat with you.
Yeah, well, it's good to catch up with you. It's been a while since our paths last crossed. So, I'm looking forward to next hour or so, you know, finding out exactly what you've been getting up to. Because you're always up to something.
The nature of the beast, as they say. Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've got a couple of our samples there anyway, so we'll be able to have
those. Yeah.
And we've been busy, to say the least, in getting the distillery up and running, and we've a couple of new things coming out in the next couple of months as well, so we're looking forward to all of that.
Fantastic. So tell me a little bit about Powerscore and, you know, what you're up to there.
Well, it started in 2000 and distilling in 2018, and we've done some double distilled malt, you'd be like to know, triple distilled malt and triple distilled pot still. And we've just actually started another run of pot still this week. We've been, we've about just over 500,000 litres of alcohol down already. And our first whiskey is probably due out in about August next year in 2021. Well, it'll be 3 year old at that stage. We'll see what it's like.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the meantime, we have some old faithfuls here from a previous existence that I distilled, and we've launched that in different guises. And on top of that, then we have one of the few cast member programs as well running. And that's doing very, very well. We're very pleased with how that's running. So we have a lot of interest in that.
I find it fascinating, you know, that you're, you know, the whiskies which you've got out at the moment are whiskies which you made, as you said, under a different guise. So it must be quite interesting for you, almost like going back.
Yeah, well, it's not as if I'm going back.
I remember.
Because I mean, it was a big decision to leave where I was, you know. I mean, it's quite a secure business and company, and to get involved in a new venture. But I mean, I'm thoroughly convinced that was the right decision for me. and I'm really enjoying what I'm doing there. And we were fortunate as a new company to be able to secure stock that I had produced, and it's made quite a bit of a difference, because a lot of people at the moment in the Irish industry, they don't have that luxury. They're all relying on other people's production and then trying to tweak it in whatever way they can to put their own mark on it. And that's fine, but I guess I'm privileged insofar as I don't have to tweak it. I can leave it the way it was originally intended and then tweak it to make it more interesting. So that's right.
Well, I think that is a very good cue to maybe have a look at our first dram of the evening. You know, I mean, it's good grief. I mean, it's 7:30, you see. It's...
Oh, well, after 5.
Yeah.
So what would you like to try first?
I was thinking it might kick off with a blend.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Good choice.
Thank you very much.
My trusty bottle here.
Wow, you see, you've been at it already, I can tell.
Actually, this is extremely popular in my house. And there are 5 adults living in this house at the minute, so I have a constant battle to try and get stocks up here, you know. But we'll work on that.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I'm interested why you launched the blend. You know, when the market seems to be moving to single malt or pot still, you know, you've also launched a blend. So what was the thinking behind that?
Well, you know, I mean, the blend was we actually labeled this, as you probably can see, with the word premium. Apparently, I only discovered afterwards that we're not supposed to put premium in front of the blend of Irish whiskey. But anyway, so in the next bottling, it won't have premium on it. It will have 8-year-old. Powers Court, we've always intended to have a premium offering of whiskies, and to bring out a blend which has a fair bit of age to it. Now, the grain in this was over 6-year-old, but the malt is actually 14-year-old.
Right.
And as a result, then you can feel there's a fair little bit of contribution from that. Even though to get the balance right, we didn't overpower it with malt either, because again, the malt is the expensive part of this blend. So sure. To keep it inside a certain kind of critical mass on price and that, we wanted to have an offering of a high quality blend for our customers and for people out there.
I mean, it's an utterly delicious blend. I mean, it's immediately, you know, appealing. There's this kind of slight kind of banana thing, some citrus going on in there. Just, you know, a little bit of kind of cut grass in the background, but the palate is just so beautiful and soft and really, really generous.
It's quite an interesting whiskey, because I think a lot of the blends tend to be a lot younger, and that's why I think this was meant to be more than just a blend as such, and that's why we tried to put in this premium. But as I said, our ambition is that we would only have age statements on these in the future.
Sure. I love the fact, I mean, when I'm tasting whiskey, I always look for what's happening in the middle of the tongue. You know, that's kind of where, for me, everything should be coming together. And it's just got this wonderful softness, that kind of soft fruit, and the vanilla begins to come through. It's not cask dominated in any way at all. It's just that beautiful balance just comes right in the middle of the tongue.
And this is matured exclusively in fresh bourbon casks. I think it's always been a note of the grain that we produced in Cooley, and this grain with this malt, is that there is a fair bit of character from the spirit itself. It's not all just coming from the wood, and I think that's very obvious in this kind of a blend.
I like the finish as well, because it gets slightly spicy on the finish, and it dries out that little bit. And I like a blend that dries out a little bit on the finish, because it means your mouth is a little dry. And if your mouth's a little dry, you've just got to make it wet again.
So, as a renowned expert like yourself, Dave, how would you describe this in relation to Scotch or other Irish blends, or other atypical blends, like you're probably familiar with the more common Irish blend?
Yes, I'm familiar with other Irish blends. Yeah, this is much more kind of fruit led, so it's got that slight kind of juicy fruit character coming through, that softness, that very gentle character. And I think that kind of pushes it against Scotch as well. And I think that's because of the grain as much as anything, because correct me if I'm wrong, you were using maize up at Cooley.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But which just gives you that generosity, that almost kind of fat quality in the palate. And most Scotch grain these days is wheat.
Yeah.
Which is slightly tighter.
I've often described the difference between wheat and corn as a little bit like drinking or eating Weetabix and cornflakes with hot milk. It's just a different taste. It's the wheat and the grain. And corn, as we know, with kind of like, and this isn't so much popcorn, but you know, that kind of texture or something to the spirit that you won't get with typically wheat based product. And you know, an awful lot of people talk about different spirit styles, and I grew up making neutral spirit from molasses, right. And neutral spirit from grain is so much different than stuff that was made from molasses, and yet, you know, even that is distilled to such a high degree of purity that in a lot of cases you cannot distinguish between neutral spirits. But I've always been able to, you know, you can still tell that the grain does have an impact on the final product. And I think
I really do think that that's one thing that kind of sets it apart. So it's not like a very famous blend which is made by another company, which I think is slightly more angular. This has just got that softness, and it's that generosity of flavour and feel and texture on the palate kind of sets it slightly differently to Scotch as well. So yeah, I think it's a cracker. I've actually got some ginger ale here, because I have, so I'm gonna pop some ginger ale in it.
Now, you know, all of these expert whiskey viewers that are on tonight, they always say to me, it says, Noel, what's the best way of drinking whiskey? And I've always told them, I don't mind what way you drink it, or what you put into it, as long as you drink plenty of it and I sold it. And this is exactly the kind of thing that people think, oh my God, he's not putting ginger ale in the whiskey. And I says, well, why not? I mean, it makes a long drink out of it. It makes it more approachable and easier to drink in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and the flavors work. And, you know, the reason I love ginger and whiskey. And you're right. It makes it a long drink. It makes it much more approachable. I mean, whiskey's got a weird spirit. You know, it's the only spirit in the world that I know that when people are trying to educate you about whiskey, they go, have you tried whiskey before? No. All right, have something neat. You know, it's kind of, So just lengthening it a little bit. I've used the Fever Tree spiced orange because I just thought that little citric thing would work well. And it's not drowned the whiskey at all. It's pulled out a little bit of spice. The sweetness is still there. Yeah, it's a good drink. There's no ice. The only reason there's no ice is because my wife has just filled the freezer full of food. So, yeah. You know, lockdown. Do you eat or do you have ice for drinks?
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes like the blend with ice in the evening as well, you know, watching a bit of telly or something, and it is quite approachable that way as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, the nature of the blend itself makes it very versatile. You know, so you could quite have that on the rocks. You could have it neat, you can have it with water, you can have it with ginger ale, you know, that's it. You drink it however way you would like to. It's a goodie. I mean, you were saying there, you know, you started off distilling molasses. How did you learn whiskey? Not even just where did you learn it, but how did you learn it?
Well, I mean, I have to admit that, you know, unlike... We always maintain that the Irish taught the Scotch how to make whiskey, and that's so true, but it actually was a Scotchman that showed me how to make whiskey, because when we started, there was nobody else there available to consult, and unfortunately, I think at the time, there was a monopoly in the production of Irish whiskey, and that's where the opportunity came to actually get into Irish whiskey. But obviously, they weren't going to tell you how to compete with themselves, and it was kind of difficult. So we were very fortunate. We had a couple of Scottish distillers originally, and we had a relationship with Billy Walker. And Billy was a big influence on us, and both from the blending and quality and tasting aspects of this whiskey. Gordon Mitchell had worked for Billy in grain distilling and production, and also malt production. And Gordon joined us in 1990 to start up the grain distillation. And I was there as well. And there was another distiller called Alan Jappy who was doing the malt, started the malt distillation systems initially. And then he left and Gordon took over the distillery management. I was quality manager and I used to take the samples. And because I had been involved in making neutral spirit, I kind of knew how to smell and taste spirit. And I knew what was not supposed to be in there as opposed to what should be in there in some respects. So I knew what was an off order and basically from my basic training in neutral spirit production. So with Billy used to come over every few months and we'd set up the tastings and we'd smell both the new spirit and stuff that we were aging. And he was there for a number of years in that capacity and was on retainer for quite a while, right up until about, oh, I think it was 2007 at least. So he was a great guidance. And then, of course, I've always, from about 1995 was when Gordon left us. And from then on, I got involved in the international tasting events that you have around the world. And I found that a great educator because it gave me a great opportunity to look at what other people had in the marketplace and what, and this were blind tastings. And I was tasting these whiskies with people like yourself who had a great reputation in Scotch and other whiskies. And I found that invaluable because you could, you know, it's always difficult to know exactly what you're tasting. And and when you do taste and smell a product, you say, oh, I know what that is. And then somebody says, oh, that's banana, or it's banoffee, or it's pineapple, or it's fruit. All of a sudden you say, ah, that's it. And it also helps you as well pick up some of the off notes, butyric and rubber, like those bad sulfury notes that you can get from wine casks and stuff like that. Yeah. And that was also a great learning for me in producing the whiskey. And again, as I said, with Gordon there in the background until 1995 and thereafter, we were kind of on our own, but we were developing. And as I said, I grew up with the whiskey there as well, which is also very, very useful now, as opposed to when it actually happened, because you were always scratching your head saying, well, is this going the right way? Have I done this right? And I remember as well when we started into doing kind of finishes like Madeira Port and Sherry, I was at one of the IWSC banquet in London. And before the dinner, there was always the tastings down in the crypt in the Guildhall. Mm. And all of the gold medal winners are all there for everybody to try. And I made a beeline over to a few classic Scotch products. And I tasted the Madeira Port and Sherry. And I came out of that room with a real smile from one ear to the other because I felt genuinely that mine was tasted even better than that did. I mean, as it turned out, the whiskey was got several gold medal awards for various expressions then and since. But again, you have to have a certain faith in yourself and what you're doing. And I think confidence is a great thing as long as you have some basic knowledge as well to go behind it and support, which is what you get from various other people. So that's where I kind of learned the trade, as it were, and continue to learn. There's an awful lot of things that we don't, you know. I was on a webinar there recently with some, they were all professors from Canada, and, you know, they just had a whiskey club, and they asked me to do a tasting. And one of the questions was straight from this guy who probably had a doctorate or maybe several doctorates, and he says, Noel, do you ever feel that you've learned it all and you know everything? And no. we don't. No. I mean, we know enough to know how to get along and do what we're doing. But and we're always learning, and I says every day is a school day, and today I'll probably learn something from yourself, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's absolutely true. You know, I hate it when people call me an expert because I'm not a distiller. You know, I sit and ask people why. and write down the answers. But what I find fascinating from what you were saying there is that is really basically, you know, whether you're a distiller or whether you're a newcomer to whiskey, that is the way that you approach it. You know, the only way you really learn about it is by tasting it, and tasting as widely as possible. You know, find out what you like, what you don't like.
Yes.
Find out what balance is all about. You know, so whether you're a professional, whether you're just a new whiskey lover, taste, you know.
Yeah.
Ask questions, you know.
I would always say that I wasn't the greatest person to write tasting notes for something, because of the there are better linguists than me and better people. I remember, Jim McCune with him one day, and Jim could these words just flow off the tongue so effortlessly. You know, I mean, I've never been at to say that I could smell and kissed by an angel and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, that is a different art. I know that my rule of thumb is if I like it, probably 95% of people out there will like it as well. And that sort of confidence. And because, I mean, you're never going to please all of the people all of the time. You'll always have someone that'll say, oh God, I hate it. And that's their opinion, and they're quite entitled to that. And I can't, you know, deny that. If I like it, well, it's not going to do too bad, I hope.
Yeah. I mean, does that mean at some point you might compromise? That, you know, instead of going, right, I definitely want to go down this route, but people might not like it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Or, are you know, at the back of your mind, you're always going, actually, I know exactly what people like, therefore, why do we have this? Go on.
I firmly believe that I like to trust myself, and I know that there are things that are an acquired taste. I mean, I learned at a very young age that it took me about 4 or 5 times to actually get a taste for Guinness.
Yeah.
And now, to be honest with you, if I go into a pub, that's the first thing I'll have, a couple of pints of Guinness. After that, then I kind of move off. But and similarly, as you grow older, your tastes change. So I'm not naive enough to think that just because I like it, everybody will like it. But I will be true to myself and say, well, if I like it, I'm not going to put out something that I know is not good.
Let's have a look at something else that you've put out, which is quite like to have a look at the grain.
Absolutely.
Because I think this was a good reason for doing it, because I love grain whiskey, but also kind of coming back to the Cooley days and what you were saying there about innovation and almost like challenging the status quo of what Irish whiskey was. You know, you brought out a grain whiskey. Nobody else is bringing out grain whiskeys. But you went ahead and did it.
Well,
kind of broke the mold, really.
It's quite a story, actually, because, you know, I mean, as a new distillery starting off with absolutely nothing, I mean, literally, we didn't have any heritage of casks, even. We started distilling grain, and we had to buy brand new bourbon ex-bourbon casks. A lot of grain in Scotland and a lot of other distilleries are tended to be matured in less active casks. They tend to be sort of second fill, third fill, fourth fill barrels, and even more. Because grain in its nature is a very light flavored spirit, and it takes the wood up very easily. So a lot of the blends that are used to make a grain whiskey around the world tend to be regarded as more like watering down the flavour from the pot still or from malt in particular. And in Scotland, you could find maybe 20 different malts going into a blend, but generally only one grain or a couple, you know, very few grains. And grain was always there to thin out. But in Cooley, because we started production, we put to get grain into the barrels that we could only get, and those happened to be fresh bourbon barrels. And over time, I think it's no secret that it's a difficult business to enter and to get sales of any volume. We had a lot of stock, and we didn't have all that many customers. And the kind of idea was, well, you know, if you have a lot more offerings, something is going to stick, and something is going to, you know, you can have a range of whiskies available in the same shops. So you're not just selling one, now you're selling three or four. And it did take a while before our grain had become, well, actually we were just tasting stock generally, and discovered that the 8-year-old grain was actually quite superb on its own. And that's where we went with the Green Ore brand initially. And that has now transformed into Kilbeggan 8-year-old, and now it's a generally regarded, I think it's a 6-year-old grain in the Kilbeggan field. So the reason that we brought out the 10-year-old was to elevate it again into an age statement of grain. Yeah. I mean, there were the Green Ore, I think the way we did a 21-year-old, which was superb. Mm. Unfortunately, some of that whiskey from the early 90s ended up going abroad. That's as much as we can say about that. But as a whiskey in its own, matured in bourbon, it's absolutely, I've always had a great regard for it and a great...
I think this is utterly gorgeous. And you know, there was so few green whiskies out when you first launched Green Ore.
At the time we looked, and there was Burnt Stewart had one, I think, and there was a couple of others in Scotch, and again they were very light in texture and thin. And the more recent one that I didn't have much fun with was the Hague. It didn't do very well either in the market. And I don't think Scotch, as a general rule of thumb, would like to have grain as a big product seller, whereas in Ireland it's just another diversity of whiskey. And I think it's a underrated product in its own right. I mean, grain has been the backbone of a lot of Irish whiskey for many, many years, and since it was produced back in the 1800s and thereafter.
I think this is an absolutely great grain. It's got that beautiful, I kind of call it slightly bouncy quality to it. You know, it just kind of sits in and bounces about on your tongue. There's lovely kind of vanilla ice cream. There's a little bit of peach coming through as well. The oak is beautifully, beautifully balanced again.
It's funny you mentioned ice cream there, Dave.
Solid, yeah.
Because we actually have an ice cream called For Cullen Ice Cream, which is made with this. And again, the connection between the two is just unbelievable. Yeah. And it, you know, we can't keep it in the visitor center when it was open. It just walks out of the place. And it goes absolutely divinely with coffee as well.
And again, it's just got that wonderful textural quality. It's a really, it's a very chewy whiskey. Yeah, there's a physicality to it. And again, you're coming back to that, maybe that comparison between Scotch grains and your grains is that, yeah, I mean, Scotch can be a little bit more angular unless it's really, really old, and when it suddenly begins to pick up, you know, and becomes really interesting when it's like 15, 20 years old. Whereas this has got that, it's not a heavy whiskey, but it's got a real presence in the mouth.
I totally accept what you're saying there. It really does. You describe it very, very well.
I mean, what's the consumer reaction to grain? I mean, are people beginning to understand it? Is there still work to be done?
Oh, there's always work to be done in that area, I think. Grain is always been, when you go to a trade show and they all want to go for the high-end products there all the time, and they're looking for something different, something new, something finished, something cast strength. And when you do present them with a grain whiskey, they shy away from it initially, and then when you do persuade them to try it, they kind of don't believe it, you know, especially something like this, because again, you know, it's not at all what they kind of expect. Yeah. From a single grain whiskey, you know, they think it's going to be light and watery and you know, run through the palate just like a galloping horse, but it's not like that at all.
No, it really sticks around. Again, great on its own, great with water, some ice, and it'd be great with ice. Love to try a bit colder. I'm not going on about my wife again, or the ice rather. She's a very warm person. I'm not saying my wife is cold. I think I got away with that. She's not watching.
Be careful now, because this will be on YouTube tomorrow.
But, you know, I'm thinking from a bartending point of view as well, this would be a really interesting whiskey to play with because of that. Because grain for me is kind of as close as whiskey gets to rum. You know, there's some similarities in there, you know, with that kind of soft, fruity characters coming through. It'd be really interesting to try this in drinks that you might think are rum drinks.
Absolutely.
I think bartenders will absolutely love this. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Some of the cocktails people would have a field day with this, because again, as you mentioned with rum, it's a column distilled spirit up to a relatively high strength, but it's clean and approachable. And I think that's what the beauty of this is as an Irish whiskey as well. It certainly holds together very, very well. It's robust enough to dilute out also. It doesn't just disappear when you add a bit of water or whatever else you might like. But it's interesting to see on the versatility of these things as well and what you find them in.
If you hear some noise in the background, it's now 8 o'clock, so everybody's applauding the NHS. So,
Well, we'll drink to the NHS and the HSE in Ireland and everybody around the world that's watching today, to the frontline people. Absolutely. I can't agree more. My wife's a nurse too.
At all times of life, they're important, but, you know, especially at the moment, they're doing an amazing job. You don't appear to have a column still there.
In Powers Court, no. We didn't put in a column still.
Are you going to keep on the grain? Are you going to buy in grain and keep that on as a...
Well, I mean, our intention was that anything that we would bring out would have an age statement, or that would be where we're looking at. If we feel that the blended market is more likely to be a more competitive market, maybe not in the high end side of things, but certainly we weren't intending on competing with the likes of Tullamore Dew or Jemison or the other blends that are out there, like Kilbeggan, where they have huge economies of scale. Our setup, as you can see, is boutique. It's of a size that is very much along the lines of some of the distilleries in Scotland that have been successful. We don't want to build a distillery that was too small, and yet we didn't want to overcommit and build something that's too big. One of them.
You do appear to have space, though.
Yes.
You're future proofing.
I mean, the space is luxury, I think, you know. I mean, whether you're in a hotel room or in a distillery or in any environment, the space is makes things so much more easier to operate in. And we're fortunate in Powers Court that we have plenty of space. We always would like to have more, and we have capabilities there to expand. Specifically in the fermentation area, we will actually need to add a couple of more fermentation vessels to give us a little bit more flexibility on production. But genuinely, we don't have any issue in this distillery with social distancing, thankfully. There are only two operators actually running the stills, one running stills and one mashing. We do one batch per shift. And so it's a nice, neat operation where each shift does their day's work and the next shift come along and does their work. There's a continuation, obviously, you know, but that's the way it works. So they do a mash and a distillation at the same time. That gives us a nice changeovers and stuff like that. So it's very easy to manage. And because, again, we're open to the public, as a visitor center, and people can come and actually go to a working distillery and see for themselves what's going on. It's very important to me that the place looks as if you could eat your dinner off the floor, because at the end of the day, people are drinking the product that we're making, and it's a very high standard. And we want to demonstrate that to people that come and visit us. This is our window to the world in some respects. I know a lot of people would just rely on the labeling and the bottling as their window, but if they come to the distillery, we want to give them the impression and also the feel for premium product and a premium offering. And we've got some beautiful visitor center features or a shop, and we have rooms that we can rent out as well upstairs for corporate events. And it's all in all a great experience for somebody to come and see the whole process, including the maturation as well. So is part of our 360 video of where you could do probably a virtual tour, and that would be coming on stream, I think, at a later stage.
Great, that's fantastic. What is the biggest lesson that you've learned in your career so far?
Now that's a very difficult question, because there were so many small lessons that make up the big lessons. I mean, I can't put my finger on, they're all important in their own way. From tasting spirit initially, to me, the first real lesson I was taught was smell the barrel before you fill it. There are so many issues with bad wood, it's unbelievable. People store wood in very poor conditions and don't really appreciate that it's a living organism that's there. The wood itself is so important. In my recent webinar last week about tasting, I had said that I think it's between 60 and 70% of the taste comes from the wood. So, you know, that's a very important lesson. And there are many more. I mean, everything from fermentation, distillation, and again, I think from a distiller with little outside influences, have a little bit of faith in yourself. You know, do the research. There's plenty of resources out there now to find out, especially very good books like written by yourself and very many more of the people that are so important for this industry, that you know, give you an insight into, well, why does this taste the way it does, and you know, how many lessons? There's a lesson every day.
Yeah, it's a living thing. I think it again, it's I think quite naturally, I think people maybe look at a distillery and they think, well, everything is set up, therefore everybody's just kind of monitoring what's going on, and it's all very straightforward, and it's not. It's a living, breathing, organic creation, you know. So it will vary according.
Absolutely.
To
I mean, I'm blessed.
And then you've got the cask.
Yeah. I'm blessed with the team that I have in Powers Court, and we had this very discussion only last week, about, you know, we've had issues to overcome in the production of our whiskey. We've had problems with malt delivery, barley deliveries. We've had temperature issues, we've had steam issues, we've had water issues, and the process has to be tweaked and manipulated to get the required results that you want. And every day there's different challenges. From last 2 years ago, the barley yield was horrendous. I mean, it was become a very dry weather, and this year has begun to look like that here anyway in Ireland. We're in the middle of another drought. Or a start of it again, because we had about a one night's rain there last week, and that's going to have an effect on the barley and the malt that we're going to be distilling with next year. So, you know, everything is a learning, and long may it last.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So if you're not learning something, you're on the other side of the turf as well.
I mean, you have to get things right, because you're going to be putting away whiskey for a fair length of time, which is a really cheesy way of introducing the next whiskey, because we're jumping up to 14 years old and single malt.
Excellent choice.
Well, you made it.
Yeah, I mean, when I joined Powers Court, I'm not a spring chicken, as you probably have gathered. You know, these grey hairs mean there's a few years behind me and not that many ahead, probably, you know. I'm at that side of it. I'm over the top, as it were.
There you go.
But so I said, well, look, if I do get it all wrong, I won't be around to be troubled by it, you know. So in another 20 years. And they say, Christ, what was he doing? I said,
well, who was that?
That's not fair. That's the way it works, is it? I mean,
this is
14-year-old. This is malt from 2002.
Okay.
And
Allah, I mean, the fruits here are just absolutely fantastic. It's moving it almost into that slight kind of tropical fruit. There's that kind of mango note for me coming in. That's kind of ripe melon, really fleshy, that kind of tangerine thing that seems to be picking up. But passion fruit, again, the oak is there, but it's not absolutely...
Yeah, I think you can taste the oak in this one. Yeah. A bit more than you can in the previous two, for sure.
There's more structure, but it's not, I think that the lovely thing for me about that is that, yes, the oak is present and it's got that structural thing. So it's got grip to it, but it's not just a big kind of vanilla bomb, because there's so much from the distillate coming through as well. All that kind of fruity character, which is spirit led rather than cask led. So again, it's balanced. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. A kind of super ripe quality. That's a delicious dram.
Well, I mean, one of the things about these products that we're tasting tonight was, this was exactly, as I said earlier, the way that it was produced. We haven't done anything with it. And it's a testament to the spirit and the maturation of it, you know, that it has come out the way it has. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of people have come along now and tried to do different things with the same whiskey and release them in various guises. But I'm privileged in a way that a lot of other people aren't, insofar as that this is what I made. And this is the way it has been since then. And I think that's one of the reasons we didn't mess around with too many of these kind of finishes and different
cast types. This is the way it was meant to be, yeah.
Well, this is the way it was, and this is the way it is. And, you know, certainly I'm not saying that I'm not going to do any of those finishes. I certainly will. But nobody is able to go and say, oh, I can put my name on top of this because I had every bit of an interest in it and what it's about. And that's important for me, and it's important as well for the consumer to, I think, understand that.
Mm. I mean, we've been talking a fair bit about the past. I'd quite like, you know, talk about the present and then kind of move things on to what's going to happen. So, I mean, it's the state of Irish whiskey is hugely exciting. You know, I mean, when we first met, you know, there were, well, three distillers in Ireland, two owned by the same company at that point, you know, and you guys. And now, how many are there? You know, they seem to be popping up like mushrooms at the moment. I mean, is this an Irish whiskey revival, or is this Irish whiskey 2.0? You know, that it's actually a complete new start, or should it be a complete new start?
I think it's more than that. I don't think you could say that it's just an Irish whiskey revival. I think this is an Irish nation realizing the heritage that they did have in this industry and being in a position to, you know, re-establish themselves as expert in the production of whiskey. We're blessed in this country with a mild climate, and I always maintained that maturation in particular, you can look at the way what happens in the likes of America's, where the temperature swings are so huge, very hot weather and very cold weather. You do need contrast without a doubt to get your spirit into the wood and back out again as it warms up and cools down. I think that we have a very subtle, moderate climate in Ireland. And, you know, if you travel as we all do nowadays, or used to, not just at the moment, you know, I mean, the difference in climate between the west of Ireland and the east of Ireland is remarkable. They have so much more rain and wet weather, which is fine, but it keeps it mild and it doesn't get an awful lot of really harsh winter. Go to the other extreme and go from the south of Ireland to the north of Scotland, and it would freeze the bejesus off you up there in winter, and you're under snow for a lot of the month of February, January as well, you know. We don't tend to get temperatures dropping much below freezing here, and if it does, it's usually short-lived and not very severe. So, and another thing I learned from an old Irish colleague of mine, Barry Walsh from Irish Distillers, he, I remember meeting him once and listening to him speak about whiskey, and he had many, many years of experience, and he says, you know, that the chemical reactions that go on within the cask, a lot of them won't happen if the spirit goes below 6 degrees centigrade. So you do need a certain amount of temperature. You don't need all that much, too much, because I think that gives you too much tannins in some respects. But again, I'm not trying to dissuade people from trying other products that do have that flavors in them. But I think that the maturation, I think Scotch takes a little longer than Irish to achieve a similar quality. Not so much quality, but maturation. I think that we, and I remember as well a visit from a famous person from Scotland who came, and we were tasting the Tyrconnell, and it was 4-year-old, and he told me it, well, oh God, this tastes very much like our whiskey, which was an 8-year-old. And that always struck me as something that I thought, well, oh, you know, I mean, I do really think that we get a couple of months extra per annum, sure, just because of the climate down here. And, you know, and this is what the style of Irish whiskey has always been, slightly smoother, but it's, and I would go so far as to say that it's smoother for the same age as opposed right. to just being smoother.
Yes.
Because that's, it's all about, you know, if you leave your whiskey that much longer, it eventually mellows along, you know. So, you know, I think that's very interesting aspect of where the whiskey flavor and taste comes from at this kind of age of whiskey.
Sure. I mean, with the, you know, all the new distilleries, and you have, that's like 30 odd distilleries coming out. I mean, should people be given free rein to kind of explore what Irish whiskey should be, or do you have to have some degree of control over innovation? And
well, there is a certain debate at the moment over the technical file. We all have the GI for Scotch, and Scotch has their own technical file, same way as a lot of other products that are produced in the EU and various other places around the world. And the technical file was written in Ireland about, well, it's been in the writing for several years, but it was only actually published a couple of years ago. And it's not a perfect document by any manner of means. It doesn't cover all of the aspects that maybe should have covered in what goes on in the production of whiskey. We were, when Cooley started producing whiskey in 1989, we were looking at the 1980 Whiskey Act, which was about 4 lines. You know, in law, you know, the main four, it had to be you know, it was such a simple act. And then we had the issue, of course, because there was a monopoly involved at that time, and had been for about 30-40 years, they had as a marketing tool had said that all Irish whiskey was triple distilled and all Irish whiskey had no peat. And this was an absolute fabrication, and a marketing strategy. And
yeah.
I mean, there are a few strategies in to be successful marketing strategies. One of them is differentiation. So you have to differentiate your product as an Irish whiskey from what was being the popular one at the time, which was mostly Scotch. And they did that by saying, oh, well, ours is triple distilled and it's not peated. And that was the case at that time. But, you know, the history of Irish whiskey is so much richer than that. And the technical file may not cover all aspects of that. And but again, I think that it's important that there are standards that are applied across a production that is now a global recognized product, and that has, you have to have a standard. And I think in some respects, we're a little bit more fortunate than I think the Scotch have a little bit more difficulties with innovation or taking on new technologies now than in the past, because of the Scotch Whisky Association's conservatism, I think, is, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does keep a tight lid on how Scotch is made. Irish is getting that way, I think, but I think we are we have an opportunity and and there's an intention within the Irish Whiskey Association to protect the innovative distilleries as much as we can. Now, there's certain practices that have been tried by various people in various ways already, which we're all familiar with, like people putting wood chips into barrels, wrapping barrels in plastic, and all kinds of things. We're not talking about that kind of innovation here. I think there's we could have a bit more innovation with our pot still recipes and mash bills than what the technical file is rigid enough about at the moment. But again, that these things are working documents. They're a best fit for what was there at the time. There's the whole issue about peated whiskey in Ireland as well. I mean, nearly all the whiskies produced in Ireland way, way back in the 1800s and early 1900s had peat in it.
Yeah.
And it was a new, not innovation in any way, but it was because that was the local fuel.
Yeah.
And it was the port distilleries that came up
with
the non-peated versions of whiskey. And of course, Scotch has made a big thing about peat, and yet they don't protect peat as a Scotch invention, which of course it wasn't, but a lot of people would associate Scotch with peat.
Yeah, I find it really interesting because, I've tried old Bushmills, which are smoky, And, Bushmills was notably always had a bit of peat up until, actually the 70s, and kept doing it, but just didn't tell anybody about it.
Wow.
The idea that there was no peat used in Irish whiskey is absolutely ridiculous. But again, I mean, that kind of comes back to what you were doing at Cooley with Connemara, by saying, well, this is whiskey made in Ireland, this is Irish whiskey, this is using peat, this is historically accurate, boom, it doesn't have to be triple distilled.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole aspect of the idea of doing a peated malt when it was first muted at the time was, here we are, a new distillery, we have to make our own malt, we have to make our own grain, and we have to make about 20 different products. And how are we going to do that with two based materials? So it was said, well, let's do peat. Can we do peat? Yeah. There's nothing in the legislation says we cannot.
Well, it's only four lines.
So it's another dimension and another twist and another product that you can use to give you more variety in the blends. And of course, that's where Cooley became very popular with all of the supermarket blends at the time. We had something like 200 different SKUs. We were supplying product to so many different outlets and with own label and all the rest of it. So peat is that gives you that extra dimension. It doesn't necessarily have to be a dominant flavor in a whiskey either. A small touch of peat changes the dimension of a blend or a malt for that matter. It doesn't necessarily, we used to think of it as like adding salt to food. You don't necessarily taste the salt, you just enhances the flavors that are in there in a very small proportion.
So will that be something you're going to explore? Are you allowed to? Oh, I saw those eyebrows.
I never say never. we haven't produced a peated malt as yet, and I have no plans of doing it this year, But I do think that at some stage we should, bring another peat out. I mean, there are other distilleries in Ireland at the moment producing peated malt, and very good quality it will be as well.
Yeah. I thought it was very, very cunning in the Irish, the technical file, not to just use oak. It just has to be wooden casks. So it's beginning to see different woods coming in. I mean, is that something you would, I know you have a deep, deep love of bourbon casks, but you know, would you, again, given you have the flexibility, would you look at chestnut or KCR or whatever?
I think that yes, it's something that you have to consider, and like a lot of distillers around, it's no harm to dabble in these things, and if they work, they work, and if they don't, they don't. I mean, there is a product out there that was using a cherry wood, I think, they ended up with horrendous losses in the actual maturation.
Oh yeah,
because the wood is so porous, and you need to have a lot of volumes of production to be able to mask those, because the legislation is that you're only supposed to lose 2% per annum, and if you're using 10% with a particular wood, then you're could be in trouble, even though it's genuine. Angels are getting a bit more than they intended, but no, I mean, I don't have any issue with other people trying other wood finishes or wood maturations. I think oak has always been the long and trusted product because of its density and its ability to add flavor and the charring and all the rest of it. There's so many things now going on with different woods. I mean, you've got both American and European oak. You've got sherry, Madeira, port, Marsala, red wines, white wines, you name it. And somebody's putting whiskey in those kind of barrels to see what it looks like. And some of them will work fabulously, and people will get the sweet point. I think that's where a lot of the time when we're dealing with these kind of things is we're looking at, well, do we finish it for 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 10 years? Do we mature it from start all the way through? What's the best? I mean, you can research these things and you'll find various opinions on this. And I think that there is so much that can be done within the industry, just within that framework, that you don't have to go off and do something ridiculous or kosher.
You don't have to try absolutely everything, but I do think, and I know, I mean, as a writer, I'm incredibly impatient, even though I know whiskey's a long-term business, but you know, I do think that there's some incredibly exciting things happening in Ireland. I'm really looking forward to seeing how things evolve over the next 20 years, even though I'm
you're the expert in all of this. I mean, you've been around a lot of these places and abroad. I mean, look at what's going on in Germany in whiskey production and New Zealand and all over the world. I mean,
it's amazing. Taiwan, Japan. New Zealand whiskies are gorgeous.
Yeah,
absolutely gorgeous.
But they have a lovely climate like us.
Yeah, I got this one the other week. This is Beaverost. This is from the most northerly distillery in the world, far north of Norway. 3 years old, absolutely gorgeous. You know, there's great whiskey getting made everywhere. It's a golden age we're entering.
Yeah.
Talking of golden, I should have got a job in hospital radio. We have a final dram here, don't we? We have the 18-year-old.
Yes.
Which is behind me here.
Especially for tonight, I have to open a brand new bottle. This isn't going to last long, that's the problem, you know. Every time I open one of these, I come back next week and it's empty. I wonder why.
The colour on this is incredible.
I'll wait till you taste it.
Taste with your eyes first. Oh, wow, this is extraordinary.
This is
rich, dense, that wonderful kind of polished wood, that real sense of maturity. Mm. You know, it's you pick up a glass like this and you go, that's what maturity means, you know. You know, it's when things move from just being simple, beautiful, fresh fruit into something which has just got these other aromas coming through. So that kind of polished wood element, that almost kind of waxy character coming through. Lots of kind of chocolate elements, honeyed. It suddenly moves in so many directions.
I'm off somewhere really special now. Cheers. Yeah. I mean, products like this are what I find, you know, memories are made out of. Where did you taste your first 18-year-old for a Cullen? There you go.
It's a stunning, absolutely stunning dram. Mm-hmm. The length of it as well. You know, that's one sip and it's just filling the mouth. Again, that kind of tropical fruit thing, but the fruit's almost slightly dried. You know, not like kind of raisins, but, you know, it's like more kind of dried peach, dried mango, you know, in that kind of realm. And sweetness is off.
Exotic.
What?
Exotic.
It is exotic. Exotic. Like yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What?
Even the sweetness is in toffee and...
So was this something that you'd been looking at for a while and you went, okay, I'm going to wait and yes, it's right, and it happens to be 18? Or were you thinking, quite fancy doing an 18-year-old?
I'll be honest with you, in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, when you're dealing with inventory, the best blender in the world can only produce something that he has in the warehouse.
Right.
Okay. We're again fortunate that we have a range of whiskies from 2000 onwards that we were able to get our hands on, and this whiskey that we've bottled, maybe 1,000 cases of it, next year will be 19 years old, the rest of it, and 20 and 21 if we don't sell it all at 18-year-old. I mean, this is the reality of inventory and the way that it's managed. Will we sell all of it this year? No. So next year there's a 19-year-old potentially there. Will it be any better? I don't know. It may not. It might just deteriorate. And whiskey has a terrible habit of doing that. You taste this at 7-year-old and you say, oh God, where are we going with this? Come back to it at 8-year-old. And it's completely different. And go then to 10 and 12 or whatever. It does go up and down and it can change. And again, you're dealing with very subtle flavors. Your taste buds can detect stuff in parts per billion. We can't even measure some of the compounds that are in these whiskies. Mm-hmm. And as it matures, these concentrations go in and out of balance. And so a bottling of, it just so happens, 18-year-old is a very good taste for this particular batch. Come back next year and it might even be a lot better, but it may not.
But it will have changed because...
Of course. And I mean, there is more 18-year-old coming. We have whiskies that are 14 and 15 and 16. So, you know, the whole idea about how you control the consistency of a product is... You make the same distillate, you put it in the same style of wood, you keep it in the same conditions as much as possible, and you even it out by saying, well, okay, so the next batch of 18-year-old will have half of this, whatever we empty, you know, so that the flavor doesn't change too much.
Then kind of leveling off,
ironing out the inconsistencies that are natural within the product, because we said, you know, it's wood and climate and all the rest of it has an influence on it. So we try to blend it out, as it were, but it's a blend of the same styles of the same basic product to do that.
It's this kind of three-dimensional chess that blenders work with, that you know.
Oh, yes. An absolute nightmare, but great fun. At the end of the day, you know, there is a certain amount of how do I put it, calculated risk when you're doing this kind of thing, that you know what you've got to start with isn't too bad because it worked before or whatever. So you're eventually going to come up with something that's very, very drinkable.
Yeah, and you have experience as well, you know, so you're drawing on all that. I mean, it might seem strange, but yeah, I thought of, you very kindly sent me some new make, which I'm not going to drink. I'm just going to nose it and pop it onto my hands because, yeah, I figured it'd be really silly not to talk about where you're going.
Yeah, I have a little story to tell you about the new make here. I asked my friends, because I wasn't down at the distillery last week, kind of keeping away from the social distancing point of view, for a sample. And I was expecting a 50 ml bottle like this. And this is what I got. So I poured this earlier. Where is it? There we go. You got the small sample. They forgot. That's your bottle here. You wish. Anyway, so that's going to keep me going for a little while.
Yeah, yeah. So what do we have here? Because you're making. So you're doing single malt. You're doing pot still as well.
Yes. We're looking at the single malt, I think.
That's really beautiful. That's really clean. Fruity already. Fruity and sweet already.
Now, just so everybody that's out there sees, this is 76% alcohol off the still. So I tend to dilute it down a little bit.
And sanitizer.
Well, yes.
No, it's not, folks. It's not. It's lovely. Really lovely. That's just going to mature so beautifully. You know, all the components are there. I find new make really fascinating because some are quite deliberately weird. And some are just right from the word go. And this is absolutely spot on. Absolutely spot on. Well,
I take that as a major compliment coming from a gentleman as yourself.
Yeah.
Who knows a good thing about bad whiskey. good judge of bad whiskey.
I think what intrigues me the most now is obviously you've got existing stock and yes. You've got new whiskey now being matured and stuff. Are you trying to dovetail the Powers Court with the old Cooley stock, and so it's just going to be a seamless transition? Or at some point are you going to go, actually, this is what we are making, and it's maybe in the same vein, but it's different?
It's too early to say. I mean, as you mentioned, this is triple distilled, where all of the Cooley malt was double distilled. I do have some double distilled new make in maturation, but not enough to dominate the production. Mm-hmm. This is, I think you put it very succinctly when you said that because Cooley had a Scotch distiller initially, and we learned our trade initially from how Scotch was made predominantly in Cooley, and that's quite true. I think that I wanted to do something insofar as go the triple distill route and improve as much as I could, bringing a knowledge of how double distillation can be made to make whiskey like what you've just tasted, that 18-year-old. The fact that there was only one malt distillery in Ireland for so many years meant that the category in Ireland had kind of wasn't really given its true attention. And when that distillery was subsequently sold off, it went to a predominantly Scotch company that had a huge interest in Scotch. And again, I don't think that they did that category any justice either. Now they're independent in as far as they can be, but they're not in the mainstream Scotch influences of, well, you know, do we really want a big Irish whiskey? I think now they have much, there's more opportunity there. Cooley, I think, and our history with malt has been successful. Malt Irish whiskey isn't a huge category. There's a lot of work there. And there's a lot of competition and a lot of people promoting pot still, and we can talk about that as well, because pot still was the traditional kind of Irish whiskey, or it was the one that was more favored eventually. Mm-hmm. And but again, I think pot still, there's a huge need for education on what pot still is out in the world. And I think that's an uphill battle as well. Mm. So I think Scotch and malt has a reference point as such. So malt is going to be, I think, certainly there for a long, long time to come. And perhaps pot still will expand its horizons beyond Ireland and out into more the world. And there are some fabulous pot stills out there, obviously.
Yeah, there are. Yeah, it's going to be really exciting. I do notice that...
time flies.
I am waiting in the wings. I'm loath to interrupt you. It's really a great conversation, and just goes to show what the lovely whiskey liquid does once we start talking. The conversation is flowing, and you know, as we all find every week, we learn so much about the art of the whiskey making, and enjoy it more and more, Dave, as we learn more. We'll be delighted to have you over. I know that Alex and Noel have invited you a number of times, and hopefully as soon as we are open again, you'll make a trip over to us. Noel was probably just coming to it there with regards to the 18-year-old, but we have a really exciting launch of a limited edition on the 18-year-old towards the end of September, early October. So that would be a lovely time, and hopefully things will be back to normal at that stage.
I'll pretend I need to test my eyes, you know.
Yes.
I'd like to go anywhere, you know.
Yeah, well, we can make any excuses, don't worry. So we'd love to have you over. So I suppose just in terms of the conversation in general, I think everybody's been really enjoying it this evening. Lots of interaction. Marijke from Germany has been joining us. We've had Caroline from California. Lots of international people on board. There is one question from Steve and Philip. We're both commenting, and this is probably more for Noel. There was a product called Schlieffoy Noel, which back in the Cooley days, I believe. And mm-hmm. Both of the guys were reminiscing on it and saying it was one of the best whiskies they've tasted. And is there any chance it would ever be resurrected or something similar? So you never know.
Yeah, Schlieffoy was an 8-year-old single malt that we did for Marks and Spencer's, I think. It was a really, really beautiful whiskey. And again, it's a single malt 8-year-old, not unlike our friends Tyrconnell. And I mean, just I'm afraid that is no longer available. Who knows what will come out in the future? But I'm sure that you keep trying, you'll find something that's equally as good.
Well, I think that's the joy of the whiskies, and no more than what you were saying there earlier on, Dave. I think, you know, there's so much happening in Ireland at the moment in the whiskey industry. It's such an exciting time, and lots of different finishes. So I think it only remains to say that go out and taste widely and increase your experience with the whiskey. And thank you so much for making yourself available. I know we jumped on a window in your diary, so we're very, very happy. happy that you were able to chat with us this evening. And no doubt we shall do it again, I'm sure. So I just wanted to say to everybody that we have a bank holiday coming up this weekend, but we will be here next week with a focus on our CAS programme. Looking at CAS programmes in general, talking about some no doubt from Scotland and in Ireland, and then just our Kevin McParland, our colleague, will be talking about Noel's first inaugural CAS programme that we've launched here at Powerscourt. So please join us for that. And as usual, we will have our webinar up on YouTube in the next few days. And keep safe and keep well, and keep drinking for Cullen. Thank you so much, everyone.
Cheers, and thanks, Dave.
Enjoy.
Thanks, Noel. Good to see you, man. Thank you.